lady had told me that the petrol station had exploded, as opposed to the shop, as we later learned. And then a photograph was sent through to my phone. And I realised then this just looked so horrific.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Father John Joe Duffy, Catholic priest in Creaslaw in County Donegal. He came to public attention on October the 7th, 2022. That's less than 4 years ago, when 10 people died following an explosion at the Apple Green service station in the village. Father Duffy arrived at the scene a short time after the blast and has been supporting the community ever since. Father John Joe Duffy, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. We have a lot to talk about. And before we get into the detail of how you handle, I think you called it a tsunami of tragedy at the time. How are you keeping yourself now?
Sean, thank you very much for having me here today. I'm keeping good, thank you, and thank God I'm keeping well. And I'm happy in Creaslaw, and happy there with the people that I consider very much my family, and I suppose closer to now than ever before in the last number of years. And life is good.
And before we talk in detail about that tragedy and the aftermath, tell me a bit more about yourself. You were one of a fairly large family, I think.
Yeah, I'm the eldest of 8 children, and I'm 51 years of age, and my youngest brother is 22 years younger than me. There was a 9-year gap in our family at one stage, 5 of us first and 3 more. And I come from Burtonport, which was a very vibrant fishing village when I was growing up, and is the place where the ferry leaves to go to Ironmore Island, or the ferry boats. And it's a seaside area, and I grew up along the coast.
And is fishing, is that very much part of the blood, if you like, that runs through your veins?
Yeah, it's my DNA going back for hundreds of years, and my family have been involved in fishing. My father, I came from a small island, and my mother from the mainland opposite. There were about 40 families on the island. It was called Inish Free, and my father left there in 1971 when my aunt was the last person to go to the primary school there. So my family have been involved in fishing for generations, and they found letters in Ohio dating back to the 1880s when there was a very bad night and there was a tragedy at sea, and my great-great-great-grandfather or something like that swam ashore and was given refuge in the house of the Protestant minister in Port New at the time. And I mightn't be here today if he wasn't such a strong swimmer.
That's quite the pedigree writing off. And this island of Inish Free, now it's obviously a phrase because of, you know, I think a poem by William Butler Yeats. But I mean, is it now an uninhabited island?
Yeah, it's uninhabited at the moment. There was one person living there. She lives there on and off, but it's pretty much uninhabited. After my people left, there came an interesting group to the island called the Atlantis Community, which set up a house in Burtonport. Then they moved to the island, and eventually most of them moved on to Columbia after that.
They were known, I think, what were they called? Was it the Screamers or something?
Yeah,
like
they were known locally as the Screamers, and they were the Atlantis Community, the Screamers. And they were from, I would say, a fairly middle to upper class family, 2 sisters who originally came and set up this commune in Burtonport. And the others came from different parts of Europe to different parts of Ireland, and from the UK. And then they also went over to the island, and they stayed there for quite a number of years. I think 73 or 74, around the time I was born, or before I was born, they arrived.
And did they get much traction with the locals? Did the locals get involved with them much at all?
I suppose the locals were very frightened of them at first, but then they come here. We mixed with them at school. I remember them at school, and I would be still in contact with a few of them from the school days. And they got on well with us at school, and the children were very nice, and I suppose it was a very difficult way of life for them, because it was a very different way of life, and it was a challenging, I would
imagine. Were they trying to be self-sufficient with, you know, growing their own crops and catching their own fish, that kind of thing?
Well, they didn't catch fish. They were vegetarian, and they grew their own crops, and they believed in screaming as a therapy to get rid of negative energy and all sorts of other situations, I suppose, that was very new to the community around Bartonport at the time. And I remember the vibrant colours on the house, and they kept cows at first. I remember them keeping cows and goats for milk. And
Now, you mentioned cows there. Was there a little bit of farming in your own family as well?
And my mother's side, my grandfather would have kept a few cows and a small bit of farming out in the fields cutting the hay, and some of my fondest memories and going to the bog and gathering the potatoes. But I think my fondest memories of all, of course, was out on boats. That's my earliest memories, is going out on the boat with my father.
And he had a sad end to his life, didn't he?
Yeah, my father died just at the beginning of his 50s. I'll be almost the age now that my father was when my father died, crossing over the boats. He fell in at Bartonport and died, and it was a year before I was ordained a priest. My youngest brother was only 4 at the time, and so it was very challenging, of course, for my mother, and we had great help around us from within our family, friends and neighbours, and people rallied around and helped us in every way that they possibly could. And just the generosity of community and the kindness of people was so very evident for me at that time.
It must have been an absolutely terrible blow to you. Well, to all of you, but especially your mother. I mean, you being, as you say, the eldest of 8, the youngest of 4, how did she make ends meet?
My mother, I suppose, had the pension, and that's what she had at that time. And then some of my siblings were working, and others helped in different ways. And I remember when I was going for the priest, I was being ordained the following year, and I remember a very dear family friend that we mentioned a little while ago, just before we came on here, Bernard McGlinchey and his partner Kathleen. And I remember Bernard buying me my suits for the ordination, and being so very helpful, and others as well besides.
What drew you to the priesthood?
I was drawn to the priesthood from a very young age. When I saw the priest up on the altar, Father McDyer was his name, who's now deceased, not Father McDyer of Glencullum Kill, but a relation of that Father McDyer's, Father Dan McDyer, I just wanted to do what he did. And I suppose I remember the comfort that the priest brought to people in times of tragedy. I remember a young man being drowned out on Innisfree Island. He was only, I think, 15 years of age. He was out with my uncle and my father and them in a boat, and he was lost. And I just remember the priest coming and bringing comfort. And I learned a lot from a lady when I said I was going for the priesthood. She lost a son at sea, and his body was never recovered. He was just about to move into his house that week with his wife and his little son. And I remember her talking about the parish priest in the area being there and being a comforting presence. She says, I don't remember if he said anything. I don't remember. That didn't matter, she said. But I do remember his presence has been there. And I think that drew me, that helping people, comforting people. And also I felt a closeness to God in my own life. And I like going to church.
Would you describe yourself, looking back, maybe as a fairly pious young man?
I think I might have been for a while, but then, like many young teenagers, I wouldn't have gone to Mass very often, if at all, for periods of time as a teenager. And I had left, and I remember meeting a lady one day from England. She was an Anglican, and she had a holiday home out on one of the islands. And she invited me out for tea, her and her husband, and just a lovely couple. And she started talking about religion to me, about spirituality, faith, call it what you will, at the time. And I told her that I had no great interest in going to church at that time. And she says, do you know that Jesus Christ suffered for you, died for you out of his love for you? And that really struck me. And then an American priest, Monsignor Boyle, came to visit the area. He had connections with both Ardmore and Inish Free Island. He was from the Diocese of Illinois in the United States. And I had been going to Mass for a number of years at this stage. And he said to somebody, I wonder what that young man think about becoming a priest in the United States. And he asked me then to pray three Hail Marys to Our Lady every day, asking Our Lady to guide me to what her son Jesus wanted for me in life. And I felt that that somewhat helped me. But I went to Maynooth and I wasn't entirely sure. And I was within months of being ordained, and I still wasn't entirely sure if I was doing the right thing. So it was like taking a leap of faith, really.
And when you look back now, you're, what, nearly 25 years a priest, 23 or 4 anyway. Are you glad you did it?
I am. I am very happy. I'm very happy in my shoes, as they say. I'm very happy where I am with people. I must say I've always been very happy in whatever parish I've been in. But there's one thing I find most difficult. It's akin to almost akin to a death, the feeling of that in one's own family. And that's when you're asked to move to another place. And it's really difficult. I find that really difficult, leaving the people behind you that you knew and going to another place. But I am very fortunate and blessed that I settle in very quickly and become very content.
You were previously, I think, was it Ballybuffet? You were in Stranorlar?
I was in Stranorlar.
Twin Towns,
the parish of Stranorlar and Twin Towns, Ballybuffet in Stranorlar, and I was there from 2012 to 2017, and I very much enjoyed my time there, and I had great support there in my parish priest as well. And it's a very vibrant parish. It's a parish that has a lot of committees in it, a lot of lay involvement. The parish priest had been to Peru and he saw the lay involvement of the church in Peru long before we started talking about that amount of lay, level of lay involvement in Ireland. Stranorlar is very much a prototype for that.
I'd imagine one of the things that helped you settle in Chrysler was it's much closer to the sea, for instance, I think, and you've got some spectacular views. It's a part of the country I happen to know reasonably well, I would say, and it is really a beautiful part of Ireland, part of the world.
When I was in Stranorlar, no disrespect to Stranorlar, I love Stranorlar, but I used to have to leave to go to the sea sometimes. I used to look out on the River Finn and the most beautiful view from the Procol House in Stranorlar. I love the sea. If I'm away from the sea, I feel cut off from God. I feel cut off from myself in some ways. And Chrysler has so much to offer. You have the beautiful overshadowing of Chrysler in the best possible sense by Muckish, which is very beautiful. You have the sea and you have so many amenities, the beautiful beaches, Marble Hill, the little Port Noblat. You have the rivers. You have so much.
You make me want to jump in the car, you know, as soon as we finish this conversation.
It's mystical,
and,
Sean.
And also your church or chapel there is kind of, it's modelled on, shaped by the mountain at the backdrop, Muckish.
Yeah, Liam McCormick, who was the architect, designed a number of churches in Donegal, I think 7 in total. And he brought in to the design the local landscape. So Chrysler is based on the shape of Muckish, the flow of Muckish. And the other church that's very famous is the church at Burt, which is based on the Grainion of Alia. And there's a church in Desert Tegney where he takes in the sea, and there's elements in it that would remind you of the sea and the coast. And Chrysler was also known as the fan church in early articles, in the way that it is shaped inside. It's a very beautiful church, very simple. And it's a place that I find that you're very much connected with the congregation in Chrysler in the shape of it.
Before you came to public attention nationally and perhaps internationally as well, 3.5 years ago or thereabouts, you weren't afraid to get stuck in on issues, if you like, that were concerning people, maybe of a secular nature. I'm thinking of, you know, you've advocated for fishing, perhaps understandably, given your closeness to it.
Yeah, I advocated for fishing because I came from a very vibrant place, a very vibrant fishing port, Burton Port, when I was growing up, where there was hundreds upon hundreds of people employed in both the factories and at sea. And the same was true of other coastal areas such as Downings and right around the coast. There was a huge amount of employment, and sadly, a lot of that employment is gone. There are still quite a number of people involved in fishing and employed by fishing, but unfortunately at the moment fishing has been decimated. On our entry to the European Union, we had big losses because we hadn't got that, we hadn't built up, our fleet wasn't built up enough, ours and the United Kingdom's wasn't built up to the extent that other European countries were at the time. Then the Brexit was a disaster, the common fisheries policy has been a disaster, but in the country itself at the moment I think there is a big problem in that the Department of Fisheries is in Cork, based in Cork, and your senior officials, your civil servants are in Cork. Your political power is in Dublin. So there is a separation. So I think that what needs to happen, first of all, in the country is they need to bring the Department of Fisheries back into Dublin, because it's almost like that the civil servants are acting alone in Cork, so far away from where legislation is made and where they are answerable in the Dáil before a fisheries committee, which was set up recently, which was good news. But it's very sad to see that you go on to the pier at Kellybegs and you see Irish fishing vessels landing their fish and small fishing vessels, and you see so many sea fisheries officers coming down to inspect those landings, which is right and proper, but then you see foreign vessels landing and there are no fishery officers. There's agreements made with some of the European countries that they're not inspected at all at the point of landing in Ireland. They put their fish onto to a lorry and send it back to France, and Irish fishermen are not even allowed to weigh their fish in factories. It is to be weighed on the pier, and some of that fish is destroyed through that weighing process. It's a very regulated sector. If you were to compare it to driving your car, you would have 8 cameras inside your car, 8 on the outside. Your speedometer would be linked into the department, and that's the type of regulation you have within in the factories as well.
Explain that business about the Hague preference. Obviously, it's tied in with the capital of the Netherlands.
When Ireland and the United Kingdom entered into the European Economic Community at the time, both countries were afforded these preferences, which were known as the Hague preferences, because both countries' fleets were underdeveloped, so that if there would be cuts to quota in the future, that there would be more preferential treatment given to Ireland and the United Kingdom, as it was at the time, both of them being members of the European Union at the time, that they wouldn't face the same percentage of cut as other countries due to the fact that they had an underdeveloped fleet. But recently, a number of countries came together to prevent Ireland from invoking the Hague preferences, which was very unfair. And again, it showed in a way that the European Union was very anti-Ireland, especially when it came to fishing. And that was very difficult for us to swallow as a nation, because we have a great natural national resource out there. I was speaking to a fisherman recently, and one of the Norwegians thought that we were mad, as Irish, not to stand up because they're fishing for more than half a year.
Something else you advocated on was the retention of the Coast Guard station in Malin Head. You actually went over to, was it Strasbourg or Brussels, to argue the case for that?
Yeah. I went over for different things as well as for fishing. But there was a decision made at a time to close down the Malinhead Coast Guard radio station and Valencia Coast Guard radio station, and they were going to bring the Coast Guard station in Dublin up to a level that it would be the only Coast Guard radio station in the country. And we thought that that would be a tremendous loss because of the expertise that was built up in both Malinhead and in Valencia. For example, in Valencia, you have people there who can speak Spanish because there are a lot of Spanish vessels fishing in our area, and their expertise of the coast and how helpful they have been and how efficient in the rescue of people. But the decision was made that it was going to be just one in Dublin. So our argument also was if one station broke down, then there would be no other. We would have to rely probably on the United Kingdom to come in and help us without any local knowledge. So it was going to be a huge loss of local knowledge. And I think the Coast Guard radio station in Dublin was built somewhat over a kitchen, and there was a kitchen fire which shut the whole lot down at the time. And Minister Leo Varadkar, then when Leo Varadkar became Minister for Transport, there was a second decision made to close it down. But Leo Varadkar, in fairness, got into a car, drove up to Malinhead, saw for himself the situation, and decided at that time that the three stations would remain. One of the nice things about advocating for those stations was I got to make friends in Kerry as well, and I got to meet Mick O'Callaghan, that legend, at one of the Oireachtas committee meetings. So I was very happy that they decided to keep those stations open, because they do invaluable work and they have rescued so many people along our coastline together with the emergency services.
You also advocated, now perhaps this was motivated as much for pastoral reasons as anything else, just for improvements in the control of social media arising from a particular tragedy.
Yeah, there was a particular two particular tragedies, and there was the first. There was two young people who died, and social media played it was believed that social media played a part in one of those tragedies.
That was, and what, Aaron Gallagher, that's about 2012 or thereabouts.
2012, and I advocated at the time for more regulation in social media and regulation to be brought in, because social media is a very useful tool when used right, and when it's not used right, it can be very, very difficult. It can, there was so much on. There was no regulation of social media at the time, and there was, as far as I recall, there was a website, ask.fm. You could put in a question about yourself, and anonymous people would answer back what they thought of you. So you can imagine some young person who may have had low self-esteem already, maybe about image or whatever the case may be, and people putting in all these negative comments and so on. So I called at the time for regulation and for laws to govern social media and the access of young people to social media. And I remember at the time a government minister came out on the morning of one of the funerals around that time and said it was a passing fad, but it certainly wasn't a passing fad. And I think then adults were affected by it, and social media can be used to harm people, as we know. And it's at the moment in our schools, in our area, we are encouraging parents not to buy mobile phones for the children in Downings, Carrigart, Creasley, Dunfanaghy areas, not to buy mobile phones for their children while they're still at primary school. We have seen from the United Kingdom, we have seen now where children are actually very heavily addicted to social media, and so too in this country.
And how has that campaign been working out?
Well, we're in very early days of that. It's just something that we have started, so we'll have to wait and see what the results will be.
I want to take you now to that awful day, which is seared into your own memory and the memory, I suppose, particularly of the relatives of people who died, the 10 people who died in that explosion in the service station in Creasley. How did you hear about it first?
I was travelling back from a funeral in Carrig, Glencolumbkill area, and I was in near Glenties, and I pulled into a petrol station there, And I just left the petrol station, came out of there, out of the shop, and was travelling on towards Dunloe when I got this call, and I pulled in, and a lady had told me that the petrol station had exploded, as opposed to the shop, as we later learned. And I stayed there for a few moments with the shock, and then I said, "Oh, this is grossly exaggerated. This couldn't have happened." And then a photograph was sent through to my phone, and I realised then this just looked so horrific. Oh, and it seemed almost surreal, and that's where I was.
And presumably, in short order, decided to head up to see for yourself and see what you could do to help.
I was on my way back to Creasla, but I was stopping off in Dunloe, and of course there was no stop off in Dunloe at that stage. I went straight back to Creasla, but I could have went back a shorter route, but I think the shock of that, I just kept on the road that I was going rather than to turn around and go back over Mineroy, Glenties Mineroy. And I just went straight to the scene. And when I arrived at the scene, there were cordons and outer cordons, but they let me through as close to the scene of the explosion. And just below, you could see four helicopters sitting there on the field below at the camp site below. And the guard, the sergeant, who I know quite well, asked me not to cross over the cordon, to stay back, because it was too dangerous. But at that point, there were lots of people, hundreds of people in there. And the top of the canopy, you could hear the tin flapping. You were meeting people, and there were people in there still trying to rescue those that were trapped inside. Almost all the injured had been taken to hospital at the stage when I arrived. And I met one of the last people that was inside one of the flats, and I spoke with him before the doctor came to assess him. And I remember moving away from him. I remember meeting the local butcher from the shop coming towards me, and I could see clearly that he had been inside in the explosion, the dust on his face and in his eyes. And I just put my arms around him, and we embraced each other, and because I was so happy to see him alive. And the sergeant or somebody said to me after a little while that there's quite a number of fatalities. It's in double digits.
And so it proved to be 10 people. But that information, I think, took some little time to seep out that it was on such a big scale, the tragedy.
Yeah, it did. It was probably the next day before it really went out there. I remember my first reaction was just shock and horror at what I was seeing. And how am I going to help people? What am I going to say? Can I do anything to help? And there were so many people helping people in there at great risk to their own lives. The building was still collapsing at that stage. Electricity had been still live for an hour, up to an hour, possibly after the explosion. And people just ran in there without any concern for their own lives to help, and to help get people out. And they did get people out. And that evening I decided, knowing off the record the enormity of the tragedy, you could see the enormity of but knowing how many people were in, and I asked for prayer. I asked the people of the country and the county and the country to pray for us. And by asking for prayer, I was genuinely asking for prayer, of course, because we needed prayer. We had nothing else. And I also wanted to, by asking for prayer, send that message out that we were preparing ourselves for a tragedy, because there were people at home watching the television screens, family members of those who were still trapped inside. Very early, three of the bodies were removed, and I prayed with each, and there was just a huge sense of silence in the midst of so much happening when the bodies were being taken out, and all the people from the emergency service of the Gardaí and the firefighters and paramedics and so on just stood there with me, and I prayed over the people as they were taken down to the creamery, which is the farm shop across the road, which was being used as a temporary morgue. And to put it mildly, the conditions in there were very primitive for a morgue. And that was very harrowing for people coming in to it was very harrowing, first of all, that your loved one was gone, but to come in to have to identify your loved one lying on a floor was very difficult for people. And still, there were seven people still trapped inside that weren't taken out until somewhere between 4:30 and early the next day, when the last girl was brought out. But there was a huge effort put in by the local people, by the digger drivers, and one digger driver came from building the hospital in Ballyshannon, and he was pivotal in lifting the heavy weights that people were under, and being guided by the local fire service, and also assistance from outside, from Northern Ireland and so on. Different agencies came in, firefighters. So it was a huge effort, and I must say that it was a very good decision by the engineer who was there from Donegal County Council, and a man called John Gallagher, who had a heavy weight on his shoulders, together with those in the fire service, whether they would continue with that operation or not, to recover the bodies, mm-hmm. which they did, and were able to get the bodies of the people out so that they were able to be waked in the days ahead. And I have to compliment all.
I would imagine from there. What you were saying earlier about your own background and having to deal with the tragedies in your family, the loss of your father and also other ones, you know, at sea, that it would have given you some sense of preparation, or would have prepared you to be able to empathise, but nothing on the scale, though, of what you were dealing with.
Sean, I grew up in a community where there was intergenerational grief, I would think. I was 2 months to the day when the Evelyn Marie tragedy took place, where six people were lost off Rathlone O'Byrne Island. The Carraguna was within a year and a half later, with the loss of five lives, and the Skeaford 5 years later. The late Joe Mulholland, that I fondly remember, did a documentary on the Carraguna, you might remember. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a community in Burtonport where others were lost at sea. So yes, I experienced grief, and I experienced trauma, and in some ways that did help prepare me. And I also believe that it was very important for me at that moment in Chrysler to reach out to a number of other people that I brought in to help me. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine, a man called Brenton Byrne, would have helped me around the media, Father Paddy Dunn, and Bishop McGuckian was an absolute pillar of strength to me. So I had a small group of people like that that I brought in around me to help me, because they had good ideas. And Reverend David Skuse of the Church of Ireland, and Susan Moore, the Presbyterian minister, was there, and others besides, members of the community, helped with different aspects. So it was about bringing people in to help me. And
but how do you go about explaining or putting some sort of sense on this, and the loss and the pain? What can you say? I mean, you know, frequently people just say, well, there are no words.
There are no words, but you have to put words in place. And I think that the way I did it, the way I structured my homily, was that I spoke about the tragedy in the first part of the homily. and what was happening, just to get information out to people as well. The second part of my homily was about the person themselves, their life, and the aspects of their life. And the third part of my homily was scripture, and to deal with hope, the hope that is from God. Hope is not something that is just pessimistic. Hope is something that is an anchor. Realizing the pain, realizing the presence of pain, realizing the struggle, realizing the suffering, that hope shines, the hope of God, and the hope of God and the resurrection to eternal life, and helps us to shine a light on the path of suffering.
Did you know all of the victims personally? Were they all known to you, or most of them?
Most of them were known to me, and it was very, very difficult. Little Shauna was in our primary school. James had just left our primary school. Those two children I knew, and I used to watch Shauna and her dad going up with their little bike, following her dad on a I think it was an e-scooter or something of that version. And I knew others in within the community, and I knew most of them. Martin, who used to and take the goods for his mother from the shop, and shopping for neighbours, and Huey Kelly, who was in our community, Martina, that I used to meet in the shop on a frequent basis, and she was so kind. She didn't know I was the priest for a while, and I used to go on without any collar and maybe a coat, as we have a fair share of wearing coats in Donegal. And she says, "What do I call you now when I know you're the priest?" And I always remember that. And James and his mother were down with their granny to get an anniversary mass just some weeks before that. So there were people, most of the people I knew quite well.
Was your faith, or how much was your faith tested by going through this?
No, my faith wasn't tested, because I think one of the greatest statements at the time was from a doctor, I think, in Letterkenny Hospital, that her faith in humanity was restored. Her faith in humanity was restored because people rallied in to help.
What about your faith in God? How could a good God allow something like this to happen? God, you must have been asked that.
Yeah, and in other tragedies, God does not send us suffering. God does not send us sickness, but God steps in to help us in that suffering and in that sickness. And that's my strong belief. When my own father died at other points, God does not cause illness in our world. God does not cause things to necessarily happen in our world. God does not cause things that are bad to happen in our world. Sickness, I think sickness, for example, a lot of sickness is through greed, through the way we grow our foods and force feed animals with steroids and all sorts of things. And I believe a lot of sickness comes from that. And God does not. God
no, he gives not a God. We would have learned, you know, in our catechism or in our school in our KRRE, that, you know, he allows for free will. So
otherwise, we're puppets.
Yeah, but the point is, though, that these are 10 good people, ordinary folk, and they just happen to be in that place at that moment, and it surely is a test of your faith. Even like, you know, the question would be, where the hell is God that this kind of thing happens?
God was very much there present, I believe. God was very much present in the people who went in there without considering the risk to their own lives, at great danger of being electrocuted or the building falling on them.
But they could have been atheists, those people.
Some of them. But for me, my belief is that God... God was in those people.
Did you find yourself just turning to God and asking for his support to get you to say the things and do the things that needed to be done?
Can I say that I found it very difficult to pray? I found it difficult to have time to pray. I prayed with the people, but I spoke at the time about the tsunami of grief that we faced, and I said a tidal wave of support and a tidal wave of prayer came to lift us. Yeah. On that night, through that day, that evening and that night, I stood on my feet for about 13, 14 hours or whatever it was. And that, you can see, is no small task because I carry quite a bit of weight. I was absolutely riddled with pains, not just in my joints that night, but in my chest and in my back, the stress of what was happening. And I went down to the house at maybe 4 o'clock in the morning and lay on top of the bed. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to manage even the next morning, because I had to be back up before 7 again. And that was only like, what is it, less than 3 hours I would have had off. And I said, God, if you want me to do this, you're going to have to help me. And I put my full faith in God, and I believe it was God that helped me, because physically speaking, I should have been, and physiologically speaking, I probably should have gone to the hospital myself that night, as such were the pains, and I would imagine due to stress and
so trauma. What were the next number of days like?
The next number of days were very challenging, because there was no stopping you. The next night we left the church open and we brought people together for the rosary each night, because the church was the only centre for people to enter into. So people came, and there was people of no religion, people of other denominations, and people travelled from all parts of the country, and they came for the rosary. So you were trying to organise the funerals, you were going to the removals, you were going to the houses where the wakes were, you were doing all sorts of things, and you were doing countless numbers of interviews, and it was very challenging physically. I don't believe that I physically could have got through this without the support of the people of Ireland and beyond, who held prayer vigils that I didn't know were taking place. And I do firmly believe that it was the prayer of so many people that helped me to physically get through those days, never mind mentally, emotionally, and in every other way.
Yeah, you spoke, I think, less than a year afterwards, you spoke at the Novena in Knock, and among other things you said that we have survived, we continue to survive, we're becoming stronger with the help of your prayers and your support, and with the help of our faith, our togetherness, and people caring for one another. It's not the tragedies people encounter in life that shapes them, it's how they overcome these challenges with the help of others and with faith, which also asks people to reach out in care and compassion to others. So here we are, like 3.5 years on from the tragedy. How what's your sense of how the people affected by it are faring out?
I think that if you ask anyone in any type of tragedy, the year after, it becomes more difficult, because the numbness has worn off, and the shock has worn off, the numbness that's caused by the shock. People, especially family members that I have been in contact with, are living on a day-to-day basis and doing their very best to get through each day. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge challenge for them. I do believe that there is a huge amount of trauma in the community, and that trauma will remain, and that trauma may not be that grief, especially the grief, may not be healed in our lifetimes or in the next lifetime, because I think that trauma will become intergenerational. The people are doing their very best to walk through a path maybe that sometimes that they do not see, and they and that is how people are managing.
Am I correctly informed that you did reach out to people who had experience in Northern Ireland during the Troubles to give you some ideas and support?
Yeah, I reached out to a group called WAVE, Women Against Violence Empowered. They came together in 1991. There were 8 widows whose spouses were lost in the Troubles, or who died in the Troubles, tragically. And they set up a group to come together first to talk with one another. They have 5 centres now, a wave in Northern Ireland, and 15, I think, satellite centres. And they try to help people who experience trauma from the loss of life in the Troubles, and they are very much involved in the education of trauma. So they came into Chrysler and met with different community groups and helped with offered to meet with the families and so on, and the HSE as well are there offering the supports on an ongoing basis.
So is
to families and others.
Is that counselling still available?
That counselling is still available, yeah. Because I do believe with trauma, Sean. I have met people who have suffered from trauma, and trauma can lie dormant for 15 to 20 years. I know somebody who had an accident. And he was doing very well. And one time, 23 years later after his accident, he was driving from Dublin and he saw an accident, and it woke in him the trauma of his own accident, which had laid dormant for 20 years. So I do believe that in Chrysler, there will be trauma. The trauma will surface in the years ahead, and people need all the help they can get from both HSE and every other group.
And you will have seen things, or did see things that day, images, you know, that will stay with you for as long as you live, I would imagine. I mean, so how have you been able to deal with that?
Sean, I've gone to counselling myself through the GP service, and I find the counsellor very good, and she has helped me immensely, and WAVE also provided some educational services for me and courses in relation to trauma and how you treat trauma and trauma in the body, and sea swimming and even a cold shower, and can help treat the treatment of trauma in the body, and so many other things besides.
Have you had nightmares about it?
Yeah, I did at the beginning. Yeah, I had some nightmares.
And I would imagine that, you know, it can't have been easy for you to sleep in the aftermath. I mean, would you say, you know, you'll never be fully over it, but is it that you've just found ways of working through things and getting on and doing the job that you do?
I think the going to the counsellor was very important. I think the help of WAVE and the help of the support of the local community around me has been a great source of solace. And I think there are some things that you will never get over, but I don't count myself as the person who is most affected, and it's the families, of course. It's those hundreds upon hundreds of people in both the services and voluntary people who are there working. They're my big concern, and not just they're my big concern at the moment, but they will continue to be my big concern for years and decades ahead. And that's why we need every amount of help that we can get from HSE, from WAVE, from others.
Now, there is to be, I think, a new centre. Is that a community centre just arising from government support in the aftermath?
Well, the government were very supportive in the aftermath. They gave money to the HSE to implement counselling. They also, from the Department of Rural and Community Development in Geltic, the Minister Heather Humphreys at the time and Joe O'Brien, the junior minister, came to Chrysler and give help. And the new community centre, it's at design stage now and hopefully will go to contract soon. And the new community centre will encompass rooms for counselling, for sport, and there's going to be a stage for hopefully drama, and hopefully the Garda station will go in there as well, and other services will go in there from the HSE. And I think it is very important, and Donegal County Council have been most helpful in pushing that centre ahead for us in the community. And I want to thank also the Secretary General in that department, Mary Hurley, for all her help. And it's costing quite a bit of money, but it's going to be money that is going to be very well spent in helping people going forward.
That's very much on the positive side and no doubt widely welcomed. And I know you're careful about getting engaged in the controversy that continues about whether there should be a public inquiry. Then there's the question of what the DPP does. It's kind of dragging out quite a bit, isn't it, the aftermath?
Well, I feel that for families, it would be great if answers could be provided for families immediately. And unfortunately, these things seem to be taking time. And the longer these things take, the more difficult it is each day for families who are waiting for the answers to what happened. And we all need answers to what happened to see if there is anything that we can learn from this so that this something like this will never take place again, because it's something that no person should have to face, no family or no community.
And have you any idea
such
at all
a loss of life?
Information or insights into just how long it's going to take?
I haven't a notion. You have as much of information as I have, Sean, to be fair on it,
yeah.
Or anyone else.
You were saying at the outset of this conversation that you found it very hard to move parishes because you had established connections and relationships with people, but then you were able to adjust. Would you like to stay in Chrysler?
Yeah, absolutely. I see Chrysler very much as my home. I have always seen Chrysler very much as my home, even before the tragedy. I love Chrysler, and it's the only place on a Christmas night that I ever stayed away from my home place in Burtonport. I have gone back to Chrysler every Christmas night, believe it or not. So I think that's a little indicator to myself about how happy I am there and how content I am there. And the people are so very caring, and they're just like family to me. That's not in my hands. That's in a higher pay grade as to whether that happens or what happens, because we are faced also with less priests and so on.
I'm wondering, and we're coming to the end of this conversation, just from your experience and seeing it at very close quarters, as you've been explaining and describing, Father John Joe, is there something of resilience in the human condition that people somehow manage to work their way through, still burdened by the grief, obviously, and still traumatised, but just manage to keep going?
Yeah, I believe there is a resilience in the human condition. But for me, I believe that resilience is so much helped by the presence of God in your life, by the presence of prayer. I find for myself, and I can only speak for myself, if I feel a bit of despair at times, I take out my rosary beads, which I find help me, and I pray, or pray in other ways. And I believe that it is that hope that comes from God, that hope that does not deny the realities of suffering in our world, but a hope that sort of shines a light that helps us to find the path and follow the path that gets us through despair.
You did get some support right from the very top from Pope Francis, didn't you? He sent rosaries over to the people, did he?
Pope Francis was very much in touch with the tragedy in Chrysler at the time through Father Eamon McLaughlin from Downings, who is working in the Vatican. And Pope Francis, cried when he heard there was children in the tragedy. He sent rosaries over to the families and was praying very much for the families. The other person that was a tremendous support to us is our former president, I might add, President Michael D. Higgins, who was at a European summit meeting and came straight from the summit meeting to Chrysler, spent the entire week there and went to the funerals. And to the funerals he didn't attend, he went and visited the families in their homes. And he was a great support, as did other religious leaders reach out to us. Our own Archbishop, people in the Muslim community, and but the people who really supported is the hundreds and thousands of cards and letters from people all across this country and outside of this country that came to Chrysler, and taking that time to sit down and write. Like School Isagon in Buncrana raised €9,000 at a readathon, which was, I think it was a readathon a little girl suggested, and they came down and presented that to the Red Cross. Douglas Community School, or Secondary School, was it a community school, sent us a most beautiful scrapbook with messages in it, and that was true from other schools, but I'm just mentioning Douglas on the other end of the country, and it was beautiful. School Isagon, which is in our own county, and just such a reaching out of support. The Red Cross did tremendous work. Liam O'Dwyer was the Secretary General of the Red Cross, and they had such a presence in our community, and a man called Niall Keane. And I will say to Niall that he was sent by God to us. Niall mightn't agree that he was sent by God, that he might have came of us up to help us, but to me, Niall Keane and the Red Cross played a huge role in helping me and in helping our community. And I thank everyone for their help and the messages and support. And the journalists, I must say, sometimes people have this perception that the church and journalists don't have an easy relationship, but the lovely messages and journalists who came to me afterwards, both in TV and radio and in print, with just such beautiful messages, caring for me, none more so than Eileen Magner and John, and others. And
John being John,
the cameraman.
Okay, on their behalf and on my own behalf, I just want to say thank you so much indeed, Father John Joe Duffy, for joining me on this podcast and for recognising the contribution of so many people who were so supportive to you and people in Chrysler. Thank you indeed for being.
Thank you very much, Sean.
And pleasure. You can find more insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts, and thank you for listening.